So, we had to deal with a bit of a power struggle in Japan, and there was a clash between the traditionalists who wanted to look at a new Japan based upon historic, purely Japanese values. And then you had another group that said, no, we're going to preserve Japan by adopting the technology and the tactics of the Gaijin, strengthening ourselves, and then preserving Japan. This was completed by destroying rebels who wanted to take control of the situation. The Satsuma and the Choshu. Yes.
Is this played into them joining World War One and part of that with the Allies?
Was it what?
Is this played into them joining World War One and with the Allies?
We're in the 1860s.
It seems like you went to the 1912.
Oh well, yeah, we're going to get to 1912. But this is the reign of the Emperor Meiji. So what did these two groups do? Instead of trying to destroy each other, they decided to get rid of the shogun. Get rid of the Tokugawa, prompt up the emperor as a figurehead, but use that opportunity to transform Japan. The Meiji Restoration is one of the most unprecedented, unmatched periods in human advancement in any civilization on Earth. In the span of the reign of one emperor, they went from being a society with life as it had been for centuries to a modern nation. Relatively speaking, overnight. And how did they do it? Well, very simple. The new group that was in power set themselves up and aimed at reforming all aspects of Japanese society. They wanted to do whatever was necessary to save Japan. So what would they do? Well, first, they had to learn. So they sent out samurai officials globally. They traveled to Europe. They went to England. They went to France. They went to Germany. They went to Russia. They came to the United States. And when there, they began to study. Some of their best minds enrolled at the leading universities across the world. And they opened the books and they studied Western economics. They studied Western political institutions and theory. They studied Western science and technology, absorbing all of this information and bringing it back home. At the same time, the government officially stopped all policies of hostilities. They were no longer going to resist the West, but instead they were going to cooperate. And in the truest Japanese form, they began to adapt the best of what they saw to the conditions as they existed in Japan. But here is the thing. If you know anything about true Japanese culture, their attitudes come down to something as simple as a bomb. If they respect you, they will look at the ground. If they don't, they will keep their eyes locked on yours when they bow. because they believe they are in a position of advantage. So what did they do? Well, very simple. They decided to use the best of what they found to strengthen Japan. But they're going to do it in a subtle way that's not going to cause the West to do to Japan what they were doing to China. So in other words, they're going to play nice. So the first thing they did was they wiped out the past. They got rid of feudalism, they got rid of all the daimyo, they got rid of all of the fiefdoms. And instead, they literally redrew the map of Japan, borrowing from the French, which the French implemented after the French Revolution, all of the noble estates that had become provinces. The maps were wiped clean, and they redrew the map of Japan based upon what we would call counties, but the French referred to them as a prefect. A prefect. These are essentially districts equal in population that had government agents that were appointed by the national government. So like in Massachusetts, you all have the ability to vote for your local government. You can vote for your selectmen, you can vote for the people that are on planning, some towns allow for voting on finance committee and so forth. It's all done democratically. You pick someone who lives in your town and you put them in position. Well, in the prefix system, the national government puts somebody in the local government to oversee it, not for the people, but for the interest of the state. They also centralized the power. Gone were the individual daimyo, gone were the individual armies. And instead they said, no, all political power is going to be held by the central government. But not literally in the hands of the emperor, because the emperor is going to be advised by a ruling council. So essentially what they're doing is creating like an oligarchy. And this central council would be filled with influential former daimyo that were loyal to this change. They basically held the positions of like cabinet secretaries. Minister of War, Minister of Finance, Foreign Minister, and so forth. They then transformed society. One of the biggest things they did was essentially eliminate the entirety of the samurai class. So previously, the samurai were like the local sheriffs. They were assigned by the daimyo to individual towns, and they maintained full autonomy, but law and order, with their sword. The people of the village paid the samurai in food as a form of taxes. Well, they abolished that. They said no longer could the samurai receive pay, because the samurai are no longer going to be like the police. Instead, a governmental national tax was put on agriculture, and the peasants would pay the taxes to the state, not to the samurai. And the national government would protect the people. Unfortunately, many samurai suddenly were homeless, jobless, impoverished. I'm sure it must have been as painful as if when you drive through the city and you see a guy sitting on the street corner begging for money with a sign saying, a homeless vet, please help. Well, if you saw the movie Last Samurai, that movie kind of explains what happened. When the government started stripping away the rights of the samurai would attempt to organize and do one last rebellion to try to save the emperor from these so-called reformers, but ultimately they were crushed. And there was no Tom Cruise that somehow miraculously was shot up with a Gatling gun and still managed to get up and walk away.
None of that.
But some of the samurai managed to be successful. They decided to run for politics, or some of them started to start up businesses. In fact, one example I got from you was a former samurai by the name of Iwasaki Yataro. Household name, yeah? Well, he started off with a side hustle when the samurai was still allowed. He would become a gun runner. He made friends with some British agents of the British East India Company, and he used those local connections to buy bulk weapons. Made a ton of cash. Well, once the class was abolished, he decided to take all of the money that he made and invest in a company, which he would call the Mitsubishi Company. And because of his connections, he would win monopolies from the government to be the primary railroad and steamship contractor for Japan. Because the central government decided we needed a national industry that could compete with the foreign competition. Of course, Mitsubishi is still around today, making automobiles. There also was a social religion of sorts that took root. Citizenship was created. Essentially, if you were born in Japan, you would no longer be a peasant who technically was the property of your daimyo. No. You would be a citizen of the nation. And that citizenship would grant you certain rights and privileges. However, one of those rights and privileges was not necessarily voting. They would create a parliament, but voting qualifications were based on property ownership. So as a result, only 5% of males could vote. Which of course meant the system would end up being very, very, very conservative. So the wealthy businessmen, the wealthy former nobles, they basically had the power to control the parliament. And this new parliament passed new laws. Gone were the feudal forces, militias if you want to call them, and they would be replaced by a new national army. Adopting the German model, all males would be universally conscripted. Any male, when you reach the age of 18, you had to register for the draft, and when you hit 19, you would be expected to answer the call. And you would go spend 2 years active duty. All males, no exceptions. These males were physically trained and prepared for modern warfare. After their 2 years of service, some would be allowed to go to universities if the government felt they were qualified. Some would go back to the farm. But here's the catch. All of them then were officially in the reserves. And they would remain in the reserves until they were 40 years old. And they were expected to muster regularly and keep themselves in physical fitness equal to the level of combat readiness. They also started making institutions that had never existed before, but they were all the institutions necessary to have an industrialized economy. So banks were opened up. The daimyo no longer served as the money lenders. Instead, the government, through a central bank, would open up branches. The government would also fund the building of industries. So they provided capital. So you could get government loans to do a startup for a factory. The government technically owned all of the means of travel, in particular the railroad lines. Again, borrowing from the Germans, government owned the railroad, but the railroads were built to military specifications. So the railroad tracks went to any point in Japan based on the needs that the army assessed as being needed. So it had nothing to do with connecting town to town to town. No, if there's a resource that's necessary for the army, that's where the railroad went. They also experienced an agricultural revolution. Fertilizers were brought in from the West. Modern farm equipment was brought in from the West. And as a result of this, output increased, but the needs for physical labor decreased, which meant you could mobilize the men to go work in the factories or to engage in military service. And they also destroyed any type of economic system that had existed during the Tokugawa. There would be no more internal tariffs. There would be no more daimyo owning of the land. All of that was reformed. Individual people, if you had money, you could buy a plot. You were allowed to grow your business as much as you could grow. You were allowed to make profit and take that profit and reinvest it into anything you wanted. Of course, it was all regulated by government and taxed by government, but at least the means were open. Because what Japan did not create, they did not create a capitalist economy. No. What they did implement is more precisely known as state capitalism, which is similar to the system that Benito Mussolini would implement in Italy. Also similar to the economic system that we have today in our country. Essentially, you have a business if the government allows you to have a business, and you're allowed to produce what the government allows you to produce. If the government does not want you producing it, the government, through regulations and taxation, can basically crush you. And why did they do it? The central government was pushing Japan into the 20th century overnight. So they put their fingers on the scale and pushed the businesses necessary to modernize, to industrialize. So that way they could increase their economic strength, their industrial strength, but most importantly, their military strength. Because what could China not do in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s? Why?
Because they didn't want to.
Right, and what ended up happening to them?
They got crushed.
Every right and left turn, right? Every situation. The Chinese got crushed. Guess what the Japanese did not want to have happen to them?
Same thing.
And of course, as a result of all of these changes, the Japanese saw unmatchable, unrivaled, unprecedented economic growth. They went from a backwards, third world, agricultural, agrarian economy to one of the leading industrialized economies in the world in a decade or two. Unprecedented. Now, everything was not government-owned, but of course it was government-regulated. But when you dig down, interestingly enough, what made it possible was all of those pockets of wealth that had grown and appeared in the previous century. So, if you, during the Tokugawa period, made soy sauce, and your daimyo granted you a monopoly over the fief to sell soy sauce, you could use the wealth that you had during that period and put it forward to spreading your business model to other parts of Japan once all of the restrictions of trade were eliminated. Sake, all of the silk, all of the products that we think of with Japan suddenly just boomed. And through cutthroat competition, those who had the right connections, sold items at the right prices, they were the ones who rolled over the competition. And interestingly enough, the Japanese were okay with monopolies. So if one company controlled the production of a single commodity throughout the whole country, the Japanese didn't care, so long as they were producing items sanctioned by the state. And it should be no surprise that the wealthiest businessmen, as I said, were the people who were in positions of influence previously. Bless you. And how big did they grow? Sorry, what's today? I'm going to have to get back here on that one. My office was calling me. They can wait a few minutes. It's just money. How big did some of them grow? The biggest would be known as the Zaibatsu. They weren't just monopolies. They became known in American industrial standards as what we refer to as combines or combinations. These were corporate entities that controlled the entire process of producing an item. So, think Standard Oil. Rockefeller became wealthier than 90% of the countries on Earth at his height with Standard Oil. And how did he do it? Well, he controlled the land where the oil was pulled out of. He controlled the companies that built the oil rigs. He controlled railroad cars that could transport the oil from when it was pulled out of the ground and taken to the refinery plants, which he owned. He also owned all of the packaging plants that made the tin cans that the oil was poured into. He also owned a lot of the stations and companies that sold his products. He literally controlled the process from ground to customer.
So he's a very middleman.
What middleman? He owns them all.
That's the thing. Yeah. Every single one of them.
Right. That's called a combination, or trust, sometimes, a super monopoly. Well, in our country, Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster, had issue with it, and his administration started going after these big businesses. But in Japan, the new regime was like, that's fine. Are you loyal to the objectives of the state? Yes? Have at it. And by the way, the Zaibatsu still exists today. And you all may contribute to them. If you buy Sony products, All right. Questions? All right.
Next, the political system was transformed.
I lost my place. Oh, I'm going to repeat this. Why is this coming up again? I said that already. Talked about that. There we go. They also, believe it or not, would establish political parties. Because they had a diet or a parliament, and they would allow to run candidates. But you think our partisanship is bad? Well, in Japan, there was no limit on political parties. So you know how we pretty much have the Democrats, Republicans? They had about 30 political parties. And these political parties didn't just compete for voters. They engaged in what could best be described as like gangland warfare. So it was very common for one political party to assassinate the leading candidates for other political parties.
So like Jamaica was.
Yes. Yes, politics literally and figuratively was a blood sport. Because if you got elected and you could get into parliament, you had the abilities to pull some of the levers of the state. But while mostly it was the samurai that did the political parties, the daimyo formed a new form of nobility. No longer were they the traditional warlords of the past, but instead they became more like European nobles. So dukes, earls, lords, marquess, you know, all these fancy titles. And these titles brought them access. But as I have up there, those closely linked to the reforms were the ones that were the highest ranking in the pecking order. Some of them having the absolute right to meet with the emperor personally. Ironically, this resulted in a system that was like England, in that their legislative branch would have tiers. So, they had the lower chamber that was referred to as the Diet. So this is kind of like the English equivalent of the House of Commons. But the new nobility formed the equivalent of the House of Lords, which was known as peers. The House of Peers. How did the system work? Very simple. The Diet could propose bills, which would become laws. But the House of Peers had full veto power. Not vote. Rearrange. Dyslexia is a horrible disease. I don't have dyslexia, I'm just saying. All right. So if the samurai tried passing a law and the lords didn't like it, they'd just say no. And by the way, unlike our system, where if the president vetoes a bill coming out of Congress, Congress has the potential ability to override the veto. No overrides. If the House of Peers says no, it's no. They also created a modern bureaucracy. Bureaucratic agencies. Different government departments in charge of different aspects of government.
Black ones, don't take anyone's markers.
So what started happening? Well, how do you get the most effective people to work for the government? In this, they looked to the United States. After the assassination of President Andrew Garfield by a person who thought he was entitled to get a government job, and he was basically told no, our country freaked out and said, we can't have politicians putting people in government jobs. Instead, we have to make sure we have an effective government service. So we created what's called the civil service. And it's still in place today, where in order to get a government job, you have to take a pass test. And you get the job not based on who you are, but what did you get on the test? Well, Japan implemented this. And what did they find? Well, no longer were there people loyal to the old daimyo that were in the gigs. No, you could actually have people that were intelligent, capable, had a strong skill set that allowed them to efficiently do whatever job they had in front of them. And then the capstone reform was when, for the first time in Japanese history, they actually implemented a constitution. This was based on the German model. So, the emperor was the head of state, whose primary role was to be commander-in-chief of the army, in addition to being the son of God. They didn't talk about that necessarily anymore. Aiding the emperor was a German-style general staff, because Japan implemented an academy, military academy system, similar to what Germany had. The emperor also had the power to appoint all of the positions in the cabinet, so all of the different government ministers. The cabinet, however, wielded the executive power in the name of the emperor. So the emperor didn't enforce laws, the cabinet did. And I've already told you about what the legislative branch was like. We transformed the economy. We transformed industry. We transformed the government. All in 2 decades. And we had a booming economy. And what happened? Well, all of this impacted the way the everyday average Japanese man, woman, and child saw themselves as part of their society. They viewed industry, technology different. They viewed commercialism different. They viewed politics different. And thus, many of the traditional forms of culture also began to change. One of the biggest forces of change was the state.
The state.
Oh. The government. They created the second system of universal education in the world. The first country to mandate universal education. Universal means both boys and girls, regardless of what religion, what race, what blah, 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 however you else want to define yourself. Everybody by law had to go. First country to do it was Germany. Second country to do it was Japan. Because the Japanese recognized only by having a highly educated society can they compete globally. So, what did students learn? All of the new stuff with the old. So, national learning plus Dutch studies. That's what they got. They learned first and foremost absolute obedience to the nation. Absolute obedience to the emperor. So let's just put it to you this way. There was no one in Japan that was going to take a knee when the Japanese national anthem was playing. Heck no. Not tolerated. students learned technology, math, science. And there was no excuses. Oh, I'm going to come too late to class. I didn't do my homework. You would suffer corporal punishment. Children would be knocked up, smacked around by their teachers for disobedient behavior. Everybody had to go, but the government or the schools decided what track you were on. If you were really smart, if you were an elite student, you would be allowed to come out of grade school and go to a university. And if you were the best of the best, the government would actually pay you to go abroad, go study abroad. But if you were average, you did not go to college. The government was not going to waste space with students who didn't deserve to be there. Instead, you went on a polytechnical track. So you'd go to school and you'd get a skill, a trade, based on what the government determined you were good at. Because the government didn't want any useless members of society. Everyone was expected to contribute to the well-being of the state. They also installed neo-Confucianist ideas, as well as traditional Japanese conservatism. Every single morning, in addition to making a pledge to their teachers, to their schools, students are also required to say the following: that in all instances, I shall have full loyalty to the imperial house, love of country, filial piety towards my parents, respect for my superiors, faith in my friends, charity towards my inferiors, and respect for myself. Males and females, boys and girls, had that instilled in them. But here's the catch. As they get pumped up, as they get nationalized, as the population grows, as the realities of limited resources began to slow down industrial gains, this caused many in the system to begin saying, "Hey, look at what everyone else in the world is doing.
Why can I do that?"
They're playing this new imperialism game. They're embracing social Darwinism. They're proving their racial superiority by beating racial inferiors. To Waska's point, why can't we do that? Question. So, at the same time, they are modernizing, transforming. Japan, learning from the West, starts adopting the aggressive attitudes of the West. And they did it for social Darwinistic needs. Survival of the fittest. They embraced fully the notion that if they do not grow, they will die. And let's be honest, they needed to do it. They didn't have a choice. They needed to do it. And they needed to do it for two reasons. One, they had to keep their economy going. They needed places to sell their goods, and they also needed access to the raw materials that they lacked. Because truth be told, Japan is about the size of California. But of the entire island chain, only about 30% of it is livable. Most of it's just mountains And most of the mountains don't have any minerals in it. They have few iron deposits, few coal deposits. They have next to no oil. So how can they maintain a modern economy?
Invading their neighbors that do have resources.
Well, that would be what they decided to do, but initially it was the recognition that we have to go get it. Oh, and by the way, if you want to be that aggressive, if you want to be that militaristic young man, well, look, we have a whole bunch of samurai that no longer have gigs. Maybe if we decide to get a little aggressive and go and take it for ourselves, we can give opportunity to the samurai to regain some of that lost honor that they once possessed. So what did the samurai do? They would serve as the officer class for this new universally conscripted army. And what?
So MPs.
MPs? No, officers. Colonels, lieutenants, majors, captains, all the way down to the level of NCOs. And what would they do? They have the need, they believe they have the ability, and now they have the military forces to do it.
Well, they're going to size up their neighbors to see who's the weakest.
Exactly. And who is the weakest of them all?
China.
China. So when we come back on Friday, they're going to go to war. Now, I'm going to warn you. We're going to talk about what happened in China. Then we're going to talk about a little bit of United States interventionism. Then we're going to talk about Japanese participation in the Boxer Rebellion. Then we're going to talk about the Russo-Japanese War. It's very likely that I will get through all of them on Friday, which means this weekend will be exam number 3.
Sheesha Misha. This weekend.
Yeah.
So are we going to come in this weekend?
No. When have you been taking your exams?
Oh, wait. I think
you can come in this weekend.
I thought
that's
the
fine.
Final exam.
No, we still have after this exam. We got one more exam to go.
Whoa.
Hold on. You think I want to see you on the weekend?
No.
Exactly. You also have a paper that's due 9 days from today. Pay exam number 1, exam number 2, exam number 3 are each worth 15% respectively of your final average. Your paper is worth 20. No one in this class has submitted it yet. It is due by 11:59 on Friday night. It is based upon the requirements of the paper section of my website. If you have not gone on my website, proflamanic.com, link directly in Engage, go on it, look at the instructions, and make sure your submission equals those requirements. Because as I said on day 1, and I've said several times since, your grade is based on your ability to follow directions. If you don't follow the directions, you will fail this paper real quickly. But if you do follow directions, even if you're not a good writer, you should still come away with a good grade. So generally speaking, the average students on my papers get somewhere high C's to high B's. Average is about 83, 84. But then I also plug out of that average the students that don't follow the directions, and I've had grades as low as single digits. So you don't follow the directions, you will fail this assignment. If you do, you should be okay. So go over it, make sure your paper matches up to it. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait to the last minute. And give me something that is good. All right?